Das Interview ist auf Englisch. Wenn ihr eine deutsche Übersetzung hören wollt, könnt ihr das über die App des Belvederes tun. Der Link dazu ist in den Shownotes.
How do you relate to this concept of proper love? What does that mean to you?
Well, when I hear the name, I think about what James Baldwin said about love being revolutionary, and that how our culture and the world is actually made what it is by people who love fearlessly.
And I think specifically in this moment, this political moment specifically in Austria, there's this sense that loving and being a lover, someone who loves regardless of condition, makes you weak and makes you vulnerable and is not a path for the future, when in fact it is the only path for the future.
Hello and welcome to Proper Love, a podcast series for the exhibition Proper Love by Amuako Boafo at the Lower Belvedere. Here in this podcast, we speak with three amazing women, Joy Adenike, Abiona Esther Ojo, and Denise Van de Cruz, about Black communities, Black excellence, and Black joy. Because here, we want to let those people talk who are celebrated by Amuako with his art, people from the Black community. Because, as Amuako Boafo says himself, when you go to a museum or a big gallery, all you see are white figures. You don't see the kinds of faces I paint there. I want to do my own small bit to close that gap. So yeah, that's my main goal, to paint a different kind of portrait. My name is Anna Gabestik, and I also got to speak to the curator of the exhibition, Sergei Harutunian. This series is a collaboration between the podcast Im Museum and the Belvedere. And before the opening of the exhibition, I spoke with Denise Van de Cruz. Denise is a writer, activist, performer, and entrepreneur. She is the owner of the Villa Vida, a Viennese queer community cafe, and is the founder of the social networking group Black People in Vienna. Hi, Denise. I'm curious to hear from you, aside from that more formal bio. What has been moving you when it comes to your work and your practice?
I think one of the fallacies around organizing any marginalized community is this idea that what our major commonality is struggle. That's not a sustainable sort of bond with another human being. That is a trauma bond. And it may work while the earthquake is shaking the earth, but it goes away as soon as things stabilize. One of what I believe my missions are is to create joy within communities that need it as a force of regeneration so that they can deal with what they have to deal with, but also as a glue for binding us together. So what I'm interested in is creating a community that exists when things are more or less normal. What happens when we're just kind of in our rooms by ourselves, sort of thinking about what has happened and nothing super dramatic is happening right now? How do we deal with the fact that so many of us are alienated from our families, are not in our homes of origin? And how do we actually form sustainable relationships with each other instead of that really confront and run counter to the individualistic, capitalistic way that we are taught to believe that we should move in society?
It's so beautiful to hear you talk about your work. And actually, one of the biggest reasons for why I really wanted to interview you was because I'm not a painter. And so unlike Amuako Boafo, I cannot paint people. And if I could paint or sculpt, you would definitely be someone that I would paint or sculpt out of admiration and
I really appreciate that.
Adoration. And yeah, 100%. But you spoke about joy, about creating joy within communities that need it. Has, and if so, how has Austria informed the way in which that you try to create this joy?
Mm. Well, I think from my European story, we have to start in Berlin. This is where I learned German. This is where I lived for 5 years before I immigrated to Austria about 11 years ago. So when I was in Berlin at that time, I could like literally see so few Black people around that I would get the number of every Black person I saw. And even with me doing that, that only and I was on the street all the time, and that would only happen maybe like once a week for me to see like a new Black person on the street. And I would every single time be like, give me your number, give me your address. Why are you here? What are you doing?
Wow.
It was very intense. But yeah, I mean, that was how I built community at that time. And it was so important because it was the first time in my life where I had other Black people tell me that I was their first Black friend. Mm. So what I took from that was that in Austria and in Germany, and I'm sure this happens somewhat in other Northern European countries, Black people often grow up in isolation. Black Europeans often grow up in isolation. Either they're adopted in to white European families, or they're the only Black person in their families. Often they're from families where the Black parent is no longer involved or got deported or who knows what. So it really was, I had to figure out how to communicate what I understood about the potential of Black community. I grew up in Brooklyn and Queens in New York, and we were having Black parties, and we were like sleeping on the floors of each other's houses when we got evicted from our own house. Like, there was this sense that, you know, if you saw a familiar face, you were okay. Right. Like, and this was just a general Black American thing, you know, like there was this sense of like, if I go to Wisconsin, right, where there are very few Black people, first thing I do is find Black people and I'm going to be okay. I'm going to figure it out because we have survived America by coming together in these generative communities, so much so that the greatest cultural export of America is Black American cultural production. That is what America now exports to the world. But that cultural production came out of a history of exclusion and struggle. And us finding ways to feed each other in the midst of that exclusion and struggle. And I wanted to be able to take a small piece of that and share that with the Black community here in Europe.
I spoke with the curator of the exhibition, Sergei Hartunian, and we talked about how Amuaka Boafo's work is often very politicized, that he has a very, that he very well has his own historical and political background and motivation behind certain things, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he always works with that in the forefront of his mind, of things being so explicitly political. And we talked about how a lot of his work and the choice, for example, of the Bay of Adea to have this exhibition, also that in and of itself is such a political decision, such a political move, also in terms of public relations. And so we spoke about to what extent is work actually political by the decision of the artist, and how much is it politicized by outside viewers or those who consume it or perceive it? And so I wanted to know how intentionally political is your work, or how unintentionally political is it?
Oh, my entire existence is political, right? Because my entire existence is politicized. I was born in Guyana, which is a former British colony and one of the poorest countries in the region. Although we have every natural resource known to man, including gold and oil, which was recently discovered. So that's fun. 80%, even before this moment, 80% of our GDP still goes to the UK. 80%. So this entire European project is being subsidized by people from the global south. And so it is very ironic that they don't want anyone that actually comes from that experience to reap the benefits of living in the society that we have already paid for. Mm. With the fact that, you know, our ancestors slaves, and now we have no generational wealth and often have very weak passports and not the right to travel and this and that and the other. They don't want any part of actually having to have accountability for that. Because that was then and this is now. But it's still now, right? The colonialism just became economic. The colonialism just became a military project. It shifted, but it's still very, very much in effect, right? So given that my entire existence, if I breathe out, it's politicized. If I breathe in, it's politicized. My work has got to be political because I am a political experiment. So this was not supposed to happen. I was not supposed to happen, to be quite honest. This was not the intent of all of those policies and procedures and red tapes and this and that. Mm. And as the exception to the rule, there's a specific responsibility that I feel to change the rules.
When you say you weren't meant to happen, can you elaborate a bit on that? What that means?
Right. I think when you create an underclass through colonialism and chattel slavery and Jim Crow and all the other systems, or apartheid or genocide, all the other systems that have been in place for people like me, there is no reckoning that your children will be coming to the children of the people you're subjugating for a job. That was not in the cards. Mm. That was never in the cards, right? Mm. Oprah was born in rural South, right? I think her grandma was like washing the clothes of white folks. This was not expected. Right? None of those white folks looked at that little girl in that house and said, one day, right? And they were very intentional about putting some policies in place to prevent that. So now that a few of us, and I think a critical mass of us within the European context, have slipped through the cracks and become exceptions, there is a further effort to shore up those rules. Because those rules are a little bit porous. Because how'd we slip through? Now it starts to look very suspect because people are having to deal with the fact that no one is hungrier than us. You don't want to compete with someone you've been starving. Mm. You never want to do that. You know, if you're going to compete, you want to compete with people who have been comfortable, who kind of like, very satisfied with themselves. You want to take the hungriest people on earth and then figure out who can study harder, who can work longer hours. You never want to do that.
Damn. I'm curious about your opinion about your associations with a certain term. I'm curious about what you think about the term/concept of Black excellence.
Yeah, I mean, I think Black excellence, first of all, I think there's a inspirational quality to it. I absolutely love seeing it. But I absolutely understand that it's a survival strategy that does not make sense for many people, right? Because it requires a tremendous amount of work. So in the service of Black excellence, people sacrifice a tremendous amount. They have to wear this mask in these professional environments. They have to sacrifice relationships because they're putting in those hours and getting those certifications and so on and so forth. And I think it's actually very laudable if that's their passion and that's their dream and they love doing that. I became more sort of like convicted in another direction. I think what in my generation, so I'm the first generation that has existed for my entire lifestyle, my entire life after Jim Crow, right? The first generation to exist from the 70s on. And I think our feeling of now having to truly implement the experiment of integration is that we get to see how much of a lack of meritocracy it is, because these are not people that were like living in, you know, another neighborhood or another house. They were going to school right with us. You're getting better grades than them, but they got the job, and that's problematic. So that lack of fairness is so psychologically taxing and damaging. Always understanding that you might win the race and still lose the race. Right? Because, you know, well, the rules and the rules and the rules, rules, rules. And they'll always change the rules so they can win. And it's, so Black excellence is a survival strategy. And it's very inspirational when I see people doing big, big things. And I always love it. You know, like Issa Rae said, I'm rooting for everybody Black. But I think that there's a subset of us for whom we're just like, you know, I actually just want to live an authentic life. Right? Like, I don't want to be the first Black A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And if I am, I see that more as an indictment of society than as an accomplishment of me. Because why are we doing the first Black anything in 2024?
Seriously. Yeah, you know, it really, it also relates to some of the discourse that I have indirectly had access to surrounding the exhibition about people in the art and museum world and contexts perceiving the decision to have this exhibition, to make this exhibition with Amwako Boafo in the middle, in the Mittelpunkt, in the focus, that this is a decision that more has to do with the fact that he's Black and less to do with the fact that he is an artist and that he's a great artist.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there has been criticisms in the past towards him, that criticism slash accusation slash you're never going to make it if you only paint Black people. And why do you do that? You know, like, why are you making this decision that's going to make life hard for you as an artist? And that a lot of this response from him was also, this is what I want to paint. This is a personal decision that I want to do. This is how I want to make my art. Mm. And it connects to this things being politicized and also things being more about identity or a certain conversation rather than about a person's decision to make art in a certain way. I spoke with the curator about what he and his team and the team, what kind of emotions they want to elicit with the exhibition, what he and the team want people to feel like when they leave the exhibition. Do you have expectations for what you want to feel when you enter, or perhaps even when you exit this particular exhibition in the Belvedere?
No. I find that having expectations really prevents me from having a true experience, because, you know, expectations can only be lived up to or disappointed, right? I think it's unfair to go into any kind of experience that you want to be fully present for with a list of expectations. You know, I have great, great faith in Amoako. He's someone that when he lived in Vienna, we were in regular contact. We've cooked together. He's painted my children, right? I absolutely love him. I've interviewed him. And we've talked about his experience here. I know that he is just such a fully formed person and immensely, immensely, immensely talented. I have a friend who's been here. She's American, but she's been here for 30 years. And she's had three children here that are all Austrian. And she keeps telling them that to become great, they have to leave. Mm. That if they stay here, Austria won't fully recognize their achievements, accomplishments, until it's recognized externally. And then they can come back and be at the Belvedere. Or, you know, who knows what, right? Yeah. I absolutely love it that, you know, he's a big, big star now and that he's getting the recognition that he so sorely deserves. And I think, you know, that's great. That's absolutely great. You know, they could have had this exhibition. Do you know what I mean? Like, they could have, you know, Amoako could have been an Austrian cultural product.
Yeah.
This is someone that was on the cover of the Time, right? He could have been an Austrian cultural product. Why isn't he? I'm really interested in that. I mean, I know, but I'm also really interested. And I hope they are. I hope they're interested in it.
Yeah. It's kind of like that like that meme slash saying that's a meme. This could be us, but you playing.
But you playing. Yeah. They stay playing. They stay playing.
Yeah. I want to take that actually as an inspiration for our little imagination exercise. Mm. And I want you to imagine a younger version of yourself seeing you happening now. Mm. What would your younger self say?
I have very different views as my younger self. I would have been like, that's horrible. Like, what is going on with this lady? Seems like a crazy time. I mean, like, listen, I think, you know, that's life. As my younger self, you know, and as most people, as a younger self, they tend to just adopt whatever the views of their parents were. I grew up in a very fundamentalist household. I had to go to church like four times a week, and I had to go to a church all summer at Christian camp. So that's how I grew up. And I hated myself and I wanted to die, but I thought that's just how everybody felt. And it wasn't until I like came to terms with my queerness and why that would make sense that I hated myself and wanted to die, getting told that I was gonna burn in hell for eternity. I think that I kind of really cracked the door open on who I was and who I would become as a person. You know, what did Octavia Butler say in that book? You know, God is change, right? Like, that's the only constant is change, right? And so I think, you know, or I attempt to live my life in a way that fully embraces that.
Incredible. And I love that you just said, you know, a younger version of you. I'm not sure how young were you in this imagination activity?
I would say like 10-ish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's so interesting that a 10-year-old version of you would be like, what are you doing? Like, what is going on here? And that you wouldn't necessarily think it's so great or so interesting. And that is truly, that's exactly what you're saying, that with this change, that the only constant is change, and that even, especially within yourself. And but we're going to move on to a different imagination activity. In this exhibition, there is not a painting of you hanging in this exhibition.
No,
there is not. However, I want you to use your imagination and imagine that there is a painting of you hanging in this exhibition. We're not in the present day. We are, let's say, 300 years from now. And there are some people standing in front of the painting, and there is an audio file, and it's your actual voice. What is it? What do they want me to know about them? What your painting would say to the passersby in this museum?
Oh man, this is such an interesting question because I really. I'm a horrible person to think about legacy. I haven't even updated my LinkedIn bio for like 10 years. It's so bad. It's so bad. I have a website and it's a blank page with a contact form. I literally am not great about my own legacy. And I'm so like deeply unserious. So I don't know what the final thing is that necessarily I want to relate to the children of the future, unfortunately. I love to think that there would be some values that can be learned from my life, from people who are committed to living in the present moment and taking care of each other. But yeah, that's about it. Maybe live in the present moment and take care of each other would be what I would say on that audio. And that's it.
That's beautiful. That's such a great summary of so many things that you said today. This live in the present moment is embracing this ever-present change, this mm-hmm. ever-changing change.
Mm-hmm.
And take care of the people. I think that the most impactful and impressive record of what you're doing is the fact that it's felt. The fact that it's felt in the present moment and updating all those things, that not being a priority, says a lot about how you really prioritize that care. Thank you so much.
You're so very welcome.
For taking time today.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for sharing your joy and your love and your care and your wisdom. Not only today, but every day. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.